Hello, 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 everybody. All right, so welcome to By the Lyric. My name is Lisa, for those of you that are just joining us for the first time today. And By the Lyric is the show where I take song lyrics and I dissect them and I do a little bit of research and really try to understand the message that the author, writer, songwriter, artist was trying to get across. So today's song, or the song of the week today, is The Big Three Killed My Baby by The White Stripes. So a little bit of background on the song before we get started. The White Stripes, if you guys don't already know, was an American rock duo formed in 1997 in Detroit, Michigan. The group consisted of Jack White, songwriter, vocals, guitar, piano, and mandolin, and Meg White, drums and vocals. After releasing several singles and three albums within the Detroit music scene, the White Stripes rose to prominence in 2002 as part of the garage rock revival scene. Their successful and critically acclaimed albums, White Blood Cells and Elephant, drew attention from a large variety of media outlets in the United States and the United Kingdom, especially with the single Seven Nation Army, which used a guitar and a whammy pedal to create the iconic opening riff, becoming their signature song. So I'll play that song just so you guys kind of know who this artist is. The band recorded two more albums, Get Behind Me, Satan, in 2005 and Icky Thump in 2007, and ultimately dissolved in 2011 after a lengthy hiatus from performing and recording. The White Stripes used a low-fidelity approach to writing and recording. Their music featured a melding of garage rock and blues influences and a raw simplicity of composition, arrangement, and performance. The duo were also noted for their fashion and design aesthetic, which featured a simple color scheme of red, white, and black, used on every album and every single cover the band released, as well as the band's fascination with the number three. So the band's discography consists of six studio albums, two live albums, one extended play, one concert film, one tour documentary, 26 singles, and 14 music videos. Their last three albums each won the Grammy Award for Best Alternative Music Album. So specifically about The Big Three Killed My Baby, the Big Three is actually referring to Chrysler, Ford, and GM, typically thought as the largest automobile manufacturers. All three companies are based in Detroit, which is Jack White's hometown. The whole song is basically a put-down of these three companies and corporate America in general. Jack White is also known to be a big supporter of both the scientist and the car company Tesla. The track is also a sort of homage to White's love for the number three. As he once said of this song, it's three chords and three verses, and we accent threes together all throughout that. It was a number I always thought of as perfect, or our attempt at being perfect. Like on a traffic light, you couldn't just have a red and a green. I work on sculptures too, and I always use three colors. I don't know. It has that feel to it. Everything we do, it just seems like a perfect connection. There's vocals, drums, and guitar. It's interesting to note that the White Stripes, when on official duty, dress in only three colors. Again, red, white, and black. He often goes by Jack White III or Jack White III and usually signs his name as such or simply three in Roman numerals. He even changed his name to Three Quid during a 2005 tour. His record label is named Third Man Records, and three can be seen on many things he uses, including his guitar picks and amps. He also said, "The first time it hit me, I was working in an upholstery shop. There was a piece of fabric over part of a couch. The guy I was working for put in three staples. You couldn't have one or two, but three was the minimum way to upholster something. And it seemed things kept revolving around that, like you only need to have three legs on a table. After two, three meant many, and that was it. You don't have to go any further than that. The three components of songwriting, the three chords of rock and roll or the blues, that always seemed to be the number. What's always been a question for us is, if we're breaking things down, how simple could they be? It seems to revolve around the number three. Songwriting is storytelling or words, melody and rhythm. Those three components. If you break it down but you keep the three components, you have what songwriting really is without excess and overthinking." So here is our first listen of The Big Three Killed My Baby. All right, so welcome back. That was our first listen of The Big Three Killed My Baby by The White Stripes. So let's get into the lyrics now. So this song is a little different. It actually starts off with the chorus or the repeated part and then goes into the verses. So the chorus goes, "The big three killed my baby, no money in my hand again. The big three killed my baby, nobody's coming home again." So in the state of Michigan in 1999, which is the year that this song was released, there were 1,245 automobile-related deaths, with Wayne County, where Jack's hometown of Detroit is located, having the most accidents at 216. Jack is pointing out here that rather than providing safe travel for everyone, they're making less than safe materials to make these cars that are supposed to protect us for the most part. Alright, welcome back. So that was just a little taste. Not all of that was The White Stripes, but just their definite kind of style. Alright, so again, we're looking at The Big Three Killed My Baby by The White Stripes. And we just looked at the chorus, which is the first part of the song, and the verses is what come next. So, the first verse goes, "Their ideas made me want to spit. $100 goes down the pit. 30,000 wheels are rolling, and my stick shift hands are swollen. Everything involved is shady. The big three killed my baby." Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, shady. There's a lot of shadiness when it comes to the automobile industry, as per my perceptions. Here are just some examples. In 1969, the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration, or NHTSA, received a report of defective Chevrolet engine mounts that could set off a potentially deadly chain reaction. When it took the issue to General Motors, the corporation replied that it had already received 172 reports of failed motor mounts with 63 accidents and 18 injuries. Astonishingly, instead of taking action, both GM and the NHTSA kept quiet for nearly 3 years before publicly acknowledging the issue. The engine mount used on the 1965 to 1969 full-size Chevys could potentially collapse at speed, torquing the engine out of position and placing stress on the throttle body linkage, causing unintended acceleration. The movement could also twist automatic transmissions out of place, making it impossible to shift the cars into park. During its investigation, GM revealed to the NHTSA that it had been using the same engine mounts for its cars since 1958. So this is more than 10 years later. Seeing how horsepower and engine displacement exploded during the 1960s, these outdated components weren't designed to handle the extra work. The media began to take notice and citing the mounting publicity which has been given the issue, not the legitimate safety concerns, GM announced on December 5th, 1971, that it would recall a whopping 6.5 million vehicles to fix the issue. Another example was the Pinto. The Pinto was introduced for 1971 and was designed to take on the rising tide of imports that had come to dominate the entry-level market. For a time, the car was a major success, selling over 300,000 cars in the first year on sale. But the Pinto had a fatal flaw, and Ford knew about it all along, which was the Pinto's maker. In a rear-end collision, the fuel filler neck could separate and puncture the fuel tank, initially spraying fuel onto the passenger compartment and igniting. In an expose in Mother Jonasson, 1977, it was revealed that Ford had known about the defect before the car even went into production, but decided that it would be too expensive to fix. The cost to safely upgrade the fuel system would have added $11 to the cost of each car. A shield to protect the tank from rupturing would have only cost $1 to each car. To make matters worse, a chilling memo from 1973 was leaked to the media that outlined how many deaths to expect per year from the defect and how much it expected to cost the company per lawsuit. The memo ultimately decided that this was cheaper for the company than spending the money to fix the problem. By 1978, the public outcry was so strong that Ford reluctantly recalled 1.5 million Pintos and the identical Mercury Bobcat and made the life-saving modifications to the fuel system. As many as 900 people died as a result of the car's fatal flaw. Proving its cost-benefit analysts wrong, Ford ended up paying hundreds of millions of dollars in civil suits, which had a major impact on the company's financial stability well into the 1980s. So, I'm studying business, for those of you that know. For those of you that don't, I'm studying business. And I remember really early on, maybe in second or third year, we did an analysis. We would look at cases like this where, this was even in first year, honestly don't remember, but I specifically remember looking at a case where a car manufacturer wanted to hurry up the production, started producing their cars and start making sales. And so they had missed a key, or there was an issue that came up during design that wasn't resolved. And instead of taking the necessary time to resolve the issue and produce it safely from the beginning, the manufacturer just hurried to rush and make the car. And then when they made the car, that one issue ended up being fatal. But instead of recalling and fixing the issue on all the cars that it sold, it did a cost-benefit analysis of, would it be cheaper for us to recall the vehicles, fix them all, make them safe, and give them back to the people, or to just pay the lawsuits that are going to come in based on this issue? And obviously they opted for the lawsuit option because it ended up being cheaper. So it's scary to think that even I, people studying business are being taught to look at people's lives this way, to do a cost-benefit analysis of what is cheaper, just to get that output out there. And this is one of the things that Jack White is talking about in the song. Another example was in 2012, after years of denying unintended acceleration to several Toyota and Lexus models, despite mounting evidence, Toyota agreed to pay the U.S. government $1.2 billion to avoid prosecution, the largest criminal penalty ever imposed on a car company. Like any other major recall, Toyota first tried to blame driver error. Then it suggested that floor mats were somehow impeding the return of the gas pedal, even while the company was hiding documents that showed a flaw in the gas pedal assembly was the culprit. Toyota, maker of America's best-selling car, the Camry, first came under fire in 2009 when authorities released an audio recording of a 9/11 call from a California Highway Patrol officer, Mark Saylor's Lexus, after the car began to accelerate on its own. The car reached speeds of 125 miles per hour before Saylor crashed, killing all four occupants. 3 years later, Toyota admitted that it misled the public and recalled 9.3 million vehicles worldwide. And I think that I actually know someone who had a Lexus and who actually passed away due to the fatal flaw. There was a huge accident in which the car just kept accelerating and wouldn't stop, and there was no way for the driver to control it, and they ended up crashing into a wall, and that was it. It's very sad. Another more recent and maybe not so terrible example is on September 17th, 2015, Volkswagen was the world's largest automaker and was enjoying modest but encouraging growth in the American market. On September 18th, it all came crashing down. That day, the EPA served the German automaker with a violation of the Clean Air Act. Its diesel-powered cars, long known for being sportier, cleaner, and more efficient than its competitors, had used software that allowed the car to pass emissions testing with flying colors, then shutting off for normal driving. As a result, the diesel cars ended up polluting far more than any of their competitors. Stop sale notices were issued on the cars, leaving them to clog dealer lots. Millions of angry customers demanded answers and compensation, and Volkswagen sales, at least in the U.S., fell off a cliff. By latest count, the whole mess will cost Volkswagen upwards of $14.7 billion in the U.S. alone. Only time will tell what the full repercussions will be. I actually had a Volkswagen, and I like the fact that it ran on diesel because diesel extends the driving life of your car, or extends the tank life. Your car doesn't need as much diesel gas to run as it does regular gas. But it's terrible that they just, you know, didn't care. They actually put in a measure that would fool the emissions test. All themes that Jack White is talking about in this song. All right, so welcome back. Again, we are looking at the White Stripes's The Big Three Killed My Baby. We've gotten through the chorus and the first verse. So now we're on to the second verse, which goes, "Why don't you take the day off and try to repair? A billion others don't seem to care. Better ideas are stuck in the mud. The motor's running on truckers' blood. Don't let them tell you the future's electric, because gasoline's not measured in metric. 30,000 wheels are spinning, and oil companies' faces are grinning. Now my hands are turning red, and I found out my baby is dead." Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, why don't you take off the day and try to repair? A billion others don't seem to care. I think that this verse is really focusing in on the oil industry. While you might care about the harmful effects of our current oil and gas practices have on the earth, there are many more that don't care, is basically what he's trying to say. Better ideas are stuck in the mud, maybe referring to the idea of having electric cars, more electric transportation, and not being so reliant on gas. The motor is running on truckers' blood. I think this has to do with the hardworking nature and perception of truckers, and how they, you know, are really hardworking people that maybe the trucking industry exploits a little bit. Don't let them tell you the future is electric because gasoline's not measured in metric. So this song was released in 1999, but he may have actually been wrong about this, especially 20 years later. Keep in mind that 2039... is as far away from us now as 1999 is. So 20 years from today is going to be 2039. 20 years ago was 1999. And there was an article about climate change and oil companies in the future. So even oil companies are now saying that climate change will hurt their business. Oil has occupied a central place in the American economy for the past century, powering houses, automobiles, factories, and everything in between. As a result, the oil companies that drilled, shipped, and sold black gold reaped billion in profit year after year and continue to do so. But for the first time, oil and gas companies are openly grappling with a less than certain future where climate change and related advances in other energy sources make them less dominant. In its annual energy outlook last week, BP said that it expected oil demand to peak in the next two decades as renewable energy grows and consumers purchase hundreds of millions of electric vehicles. So at first I read that sentence and I thought that means that it is continuing to increase, but it means peak. So within the next two decades, within the next 20 years, it's not only going to increase, but it's going to stop increasing as well and start to decrease. In an outlook released in February, ExxonMobil projected a peak in demand for gasoline in the coming decades and acknowledged that some of its assets may not be attractive investments as a result of the shifting energy market. These changes may sound subtle, but they signify a marked shift in direction in an industry that for years fought government climate regulation and in many cases sought to murky the science underpinning the need for action on global warming. The recognition of the energy transition has grown over the past year with the oil and gas players, says Marie-Helene Ben-Samoun, a Houston-based partner at the Boston Consulting Group. They are not only acknowledging global warming, but they are also acknowledging the energy transition and the impact on their own portfolio. The biggest change for oil and gas companies will be the declining need for oil to power the internal combustion engine as electric vehicles become more prevalent and the remaining gas-powered cars become more efficient. ExxonMobil projected this year that demand for liquid fuel for passenger vehicles will likely peak by 2040. BP reports that the total number of electric cars could hit 300 million by 2040, dealing a significant blow to fuel consumption. That rise plays a significant role given that nearly half of oil consumed in the U.S. in 2016 was used to produce motor gasoline, according to data from the Energy Information Administration. Fossil fuel companies also face increased competition from renewable energy sources. ExxonMobil projects 400% growth in wind and solar power by 2040, while BP says that renewable energy will make up 40% of growth in energy production in the same period. So in the next 20 years, solar and wind power are going to grow by 400%, and there will be a 40% growth rate in renewable energy in the next 20 years. Today, wind, solar make up only around 7% of the U.S. electrical supply. But despite the enormous challenges oil and gas companies insist they have an integral role in the future of our energy. Natural gas, along with renewables, will continue to replace coal in the power sector. And oil remains an essential product for petrochemicals, jet fuel, and other refined petroleum products. In some cases, oil companies will shift some of their refineries from making gasoline to making other petroleum products. Spencer Dale, PP's chief economist, described the future of oil demand as one of plateau rather than peak. So while Exxon was saying that there's going to be a peak in the next 20 years, BP is saying that it's probably just going to plateau. The suggestion of some people that rapid growth in electric cars will lead to the collapse in oil demand is just not borne out in the basic arithmetic, he said at a presentation in Washington. The world will need to carry on investing in new oil production for many years to come in order to meet the world's oil needs. Well, I guess we all need to keep in mind that oil does go into the making of plastics, and it goes into the making of a lot of different materials. Plastic is probably the number one thing, because if you look around, I guarantee 90% of the things around you are made of plastic, whether it's your clothes, your school books, the computer that I'm sitting at right now. So oil might still be pretty prevalent. The acknowledgement, however, from oil companies is subtle enough that a casual observer could be forgiven for missing it, but it still represents a remarkable shift. In some cases, oil companies have understood the risk climate change posed to their business for decades while still spending heavily to undermine the credibility of climate change science and undercut policy efforts to address it. That posture has changed as the science of climate change has become increasingly undeniable and countries across the globe push the energy sector away from fossil fuels. Despite a burst of environmental deregulation and climate change skepticism from President Donald Trump, most large oil and gas companies today acknowledge climate change and try to push for policy solutions that will still leave them a significant role in the energy future. You can act in the U.S. market, but in the end, your demand is made by consumers, and the market is global. The global trend is happening no matter what the regulator would do. But the growing acknowledgement of climate change and the coming evolution of the energy sector is a business decision, and oils and gas companies are not necessarily working to address the issue beyond stabilizing their bottom line. As a report from the 50/50 Climate Project, which pushes big business to address climate change, highlights a slew of recent initiatives undertaken by oil and gas companies to slow progress on climate change. More than 20 of the country's biggest utilities and oil and gas companies lack measured consideration for the risks of climate change, according to the report. Ultimately, while the oil and gas industry's vision of a low-carbon future may have inched closer to the position of scientists and policymakers concerned about climate change, the two opposing sides still remain a mile apart with no bridge in sight. So while it may be good that they're at least acknowledging the fact that they might have to start to change their practices and start looking for new ways to expand their business, and at least they're not continuing to deny climate change, they're still profiting off of oil, so they're not looking to just completely halt that anytime soon. 30,000 wheels are spinning, and oil company faces are grinning. Now my hands are turning red, and I found out my baby is dead. So that's the rest of the second verse. I also wanted to talk about a little bit about the trucking industry here. So I'm not a trucker myself, obviously, and I'm not really sure about the ins and outs, other than any person that I know personally who works as a trucker is a very hardworking individual. But reading one article made me question their safety or maybe the trucking industry in general. An article from a local newspaper somewhere in the U.S. wrote that there were Georgia truckers, some on controlled substances, driving trucks with bad brakes, worn out tires, or missing parts crisscrossing the country, federal investigators found. In April of 2018, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration announced its order for Acworth-based Daya Trucking to cease all operations and report the locations of all its trucks. Daya's complete and utter lack of compliance substantially increases the likelihood of serious injury or death for its drivers and the motoring public if the operations of Daya are not discontinued. The FMCSA wrote in its imminent hazard operations out of service order. Federal transportation records show that the company has had one crash resulting in an injury and no fatal collisions in the last 24 months. Those records also show that Daya has 39 commercial hauling trucks and 44 drivers. Federal investigators wrote that Daya is a hazard to the public because of its widespread non-compliance with federal safety regulations, evasions of those regulations, and falsification of records, according to the feds. Daya did not respond to phone calls or emails for any comments. In the past 12 months, the feds said 46% of Daya vehicles were found to have safety issues like exposed tire fabric, defective brakes, and broken or missing axle position components. Daya did not respond to phone calls and emails for comment. Some truckers for the company drove with suspended CDL licenses, said the Federal Department of Transportation. From the 1st of January 2018 to 2 months later, February 28th, there were 4,802 unaccounted driving hours because truckers drove with loose or unplugged monitoring equipment. After reviewing the company, investigators found that 42% of their truckers submitted false driving logs. The company also has a problem with testing its drivers for drugs and alcohol. The feds found that 4 drivers tested positive for a controlled substance. The company's trouble began in 2017 when it was known by a different name, Ecam Truck Line. After an investigation last year, or the previous year before this article, Ecam agreed to consent order to comply with federal regulations. However, they failed to comply with virtually all provisions in the consent order and instead evaded the consent order by applying for registration as Daya, the feds wrote. So basically, instead of complying with the regulations, they just changed their business name and re-registered under a new name. Georgia business records show Daya formed in June 2017 and is registered to an old Cherokee Street address in Acworth. Trucking companies who change their names to skirt discipline are known in the trucking industry as chameleon carriers, according to attorneys and news reports. If Daya wants to keep on trucking, it must put into place a slew of new safeguards and inform the government, according to the federal agency. The Tuesday announcement said that Daya could face civil fines and the agency may refer this matter for criminal prosecution. Any criminal charges would come from the Justice Department or the U.S. Department of Transportation's Inspector General. The agency that shut down Daya also wouldn't comment on the case specifically. They said his office had issues about a couple dozen of imminent hazard orders a year. Regarding chameleon carriers, they said there is a vetting process during which many reincarnated businesses are weeded out. Again, he declined to comment on Daya's vetting process. So reading something like this makes me really worried about the trucking industry. I know this is kind of one case and it's not something that we read about very often. Thank goodness. Hopefully it stays that way. Hopefully trucking companies are complying with the regulations. But this does bring on issues such as Humboldt. We all know the Humboldt crash that happened on April 6, 2016. For those of you that don't remember, a quick reminder is that on April 6, 2018, 16 people were killed and 13 injured when a northbound coach bus struck a westbound semi-trailer truck near Armley, Saskatchewan, Canada. The semi-trailer had failed to yield a flashing stop sign at the intersection of Highways 35 and 335. The semi was traveling at a speed of approximately 100 kilometers an hour. Most of the dead and injured were players from the Humboldt Broncos, a junior ice hockey team that plays in the Saskatchewan Junior Hockey League. On July 6, 2018, the RCMP charged 29-year-old Jaskarat Singh Sidhu, the driver of the semi-trailer, with 16 counts of dangerous operation of a motor vehicle causing death and 13 counts of dangerous operation of a motor vehicle causing bodily injury. On January 8, 2019, he pleaded guilty to those charges. The crash made news across Canada and the U.S. and prompted condolences from public figures and celebrities. There were vigils and tributes, such as people leaving hockey sticks outside their doors. A GoFundMe crowdfunding campaign set a national record by raising more than $15 million. Sidhu was not under the influence of drugs or alcohol at the time and was not distracted by a cell phone. He claimed that he was watching a tarp that had come loose earlier. Glenn Dorkson, the Broncos bus driver, saw the transport truck blow through the stop sign and hit his brakes 24 meters before the intersection, but there was no way for him to evade it. The bus struck the truck's front trailer in a T-bone collision. The bus sustained massive damage, particularly at the front. The driver and 13 passengers were killed immediately. Two others died from their injuries in hospital. So even if you're complying with all the regulations, you're not looking at your cell phone, you're not under drugs or you're not drunk, just the slightest, you know, you've maybe missed the signs for the stop sign. Apparently, it was a flashing stop sign. It was around 5 p.m., so it was a clear day. Nothing was obstructing his view. There wasn't, like, glare in his eye. They, like, did the entire investigation and report. So they found him ultimately the cause of the deaths of 15 people. It's actually interesting. I don't know if you guys know about crash statistics, but the most crashes occur during the best conditions. And this is probably because people get overly confident with A, their driving abilities, B, their awareness of the road, C, you know, their control of their vehicle, et cetera, et cetera. Just get overly confident. Whereas in bad conditions, everyone starts to get much more cautious and, you know, more safe in their driving habits. So, you know, when I read about trucking companies that are evading regulations and whose drivers have not passed drug or alcohol tests, it makes me worried, because even someone who wasn't under any kind of influence still was able, or there was the opportunity to hurt many lives. So it's just something that's, you know, again, shady in the trucking industry, as Jack White is singing about. Alright, so welcome back. We're just nearing the end of our program here. So, again, for those of you that are just joining, we are looking at the White Stripes' the Big Three Killed My Baby. So we've gotten through the chorus, we've gotten through the first two verses. Again, this is Jack White's commentary on the automobile industry and how profit-hungry it really is. So we've gotten to the third verse, and it goes, "Well, I've said it now, nothing's changed. People are burning for pocket change, and creative minds are lazy. The Big Three killed your baby." So that global oil demand growth is forecast to decelerate steadily at a level of only 0.3 MB per diem. I don't really know what that measurement is. I think it's something to do with I don't know. But by a level of only 0.3 every year between 2035 and 2040. This is a result of decelerating population and GDP growth, the structural shift on the global economy, further efficiency improvements driven by a tightening of energy policies, and or technological improvements and fuel switching, particularly in the road transportation sector. So basically, the third verse, Jack is saying, I've warned you guys all the oil companies and the car companies, they want to do is make money. They don't care about the lives of people. They don't care about the environment. So that's what I've got to say, that everyone just wants some money. However, this song was released in 1999, and reading over the oil forecast reports for the next 20 years, for 2040, it's saying that the oil demand growth globally is expected to start decreasing by 2035, not by much, only by 0.3, but nonetheless decreasing. Demand in the road transportation sector is anticipated to increase by 5.4 between 2016 and 2040. But the differentiation exists between the OECD, which is developed countries, and developing countries. In the former, in developed countries, oil demand is expected to decline by 7, while in developing countries, it's estimated to increase by 12. So this could go either way. As developing countries kind of catch up to the first world, they start to use more oil-based products, start to use more gasoline-powered products. Their oil demand is going to increase, whereas us in the first world, who are already seeing and concerned with the dangers of climate change, are going to decrease that demand. We will most likely see companies that think opposite to Exxon before we learn that ExxonMobil is acknowledging how important climate change is to fight, and is basically saying that oil is not a very good investment, but that they are looking to stay present in the changes coming to the energy sector. So companies that do not think this way and who want to hang on to the profitability of oil and gas will begin to expand operations into developing economies, and they will continue to, you know, make their profits that way, maybe not fully changing on their, you know, main business foundations, but at least acknowledging the fact that they need to start doing business a little differently. One sliver of hope that I have, though, is that, you know, maybe it won't be so successful in the developing countries, due to a concept learned in my business policy class, my global policy class. We learned about something called reverse innovation. So basically, reverse innovation is people in developing countries create or innovate products in order to serve their needs, but then those products can be brought into the first world and, you know, serve first world needs that we maybe didn't know we had. So one of the examples I think that we had in class was a man in India made, you know, an edible spoon where you use the spoon to, you know, drink your soup and then you can eat it after, so it has no waste. I think someone in India also invented leaf plates, so plates that are kind of pressed into the leaves that are pressed into the shape of a plate. And again, they're 100% biodegradable. So they're making these because they don't have access to the luxuries that we are used to. They don't have access to plastics manufacturing. They don't have that much access to oil, although that is expected to grow. So they've come up with creative solutions such as, you know, things that are biodegradable, things that have zero waste, in order to help them live their lives. But we can learn from them, because we definitely need to stop relying on oil-based products such as plastics and gasoline and take examples. And hopefully we can fuel not only our own economy's growth, but the developing world's economy's growth. So to finish off, the outro for the song is, "And my baby's my common sense, so don't feed me planned obsolescence." Yeah, my baby's my common sense, so don't feed me planned obsolescence. Planned obsolescence refers to the practice of creating a product that has a limited functional life. After a set period of time, the product either loses functionality, falls out of fashion, or becomes obsolete. The practice is carried out by companies because it forces consumers to constantly buy new models. Obviously, this is particularly prevalent in the automobile industry, especially where we see incompatibility between parts and repairing. So if one fuse in my car goes out, I have to take it to the Acura dealer because they have the Acura-specific parts that are going to fix my Acura-specific engine. I can't go to any dealer. They might not have the right parts, the right size, the right length, whatever. It only adds on to the shadiness of the automobile industry as a whole, in my opinion. And then the final two lines of the song are, I'm about to have another blowout. I'm about to have another blowout. So this is actually a reference to the Firestone tires being renowned in the 70s for failing at high speeds. This is the whole situation. In 1990, when Ford released its all-new Explorer, SUVs accounted for 7% of the U.S. auto market. By 1999, they accounted for nearly 20% and were continuing to grow in popularity. The Ford Firestone rollover scandal of 2000 didn't stop the popularity of the SUV, but it set off a nationwide panic and drove home just how prone to rollovers the high-riding trucks really were. The Explorer was introduced to replace the dangerously rollover-prone Bronco II in the 1990, and it went on to become one of the best-selling vehicles of the decade. For tires, Ford partnered with Firestone, which had been its preferred tire supplier for nearly 100 years. But when the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration asked both Ford and Firestone to investigate a high rate of blowouts that led to rollovers, Ford blamed Firestone, and Firestone blamed Ford. Faced with the responsibility of up to 100 deaths worldwide, the tire company initially recalled 6.5 million tires, blaming heat, low tire pressure, and the Explorer's weight and handling characteristics for accidents. Ford followed suit a few months later, recalling an additional 13 million tires, with Ford CEO Jacques Nasser declaring, "We simply do not have enough confidence in the future performance of these tires, keeping our customers safe." After executives from both companies dragged each other through the mud during televised congressional hearings, Firestone and Ford parted ways in 2002. Whether the tires were flawed or Ford's engineering was bad, it didn't matter. After millions of dollars were paid out by both companies in lawsuits, neither company has taken full responsibility still to this day. So basically, Jack White is saying the automobile industry sucks and we all need to focus our sights on better pastures. So I'm going to play the Big Three Kill Baby one more time. And then after that, I wanted to play Seven Nation Army, just so you guys know who this band is and where you might know them from. All right, so everybody, that was the White Stripes, first with their song The Big Three Killed My Baby, and then by their notoriously famous Seven Nation Army. Just a little fun fact, Jack White and Meg White, although they initially advertised themselves as siblings, are actually ex-husband and ex-wife. The reason that they said that they were siblings to the public is so that people wouldn't focus so much on their relationship as much as the music they were making. And Seven Nation Army, just another fun fact, is what Jack named the riff while he was working on it, because it's what he used to call the Salvation Army when he was younger. Instead of calling it the Salvation Army, he would call it the Seven Nation Army. So yeah, that's just some fun facts for the end of the show. Thanks for everybody if you've tuned in. If you have any other cool songs that you think would be interesting for me to do some research on and talk about, don't forget to tweet at Radio Laurier or send us a message on Instagram, again, at Radio Laurier. And I hope everyone has a fun and safe weekend. We'll see you next week.